Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Joe Wood, who in February 2021 took up the post of chair of Vocalise, the national charity providing access to the arts through audio description for blind and partially sighted people. Through Joe's Tracks of My Life, we take a journey from her early family life, growing up in the southeast of England, surprising herself, her family and her school, by getting into Cambridge to read history. Jo will then reflect on the time from 2014 to 2015, when Jo first had a detached retina in her left eye and then in her right eye, which started her sight loss journey, and then an encounter with audio description at Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in 2017, which was a turning point for Jo in her new visually impaired life. Hello, Jo, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, Toby. Thank you so much for having me. Although I will confess, I feel very underqualified compared to your previous guests. I still feel very much like the new kid on the visually impaired block, but thanks for having me.
Don't worry about that at all. So, Jo, how did you find it selecting your tracks? Was it a bit of a tricky process?
Oh, it was so tricky because I was really torn. So, you know, they're the songs that I listen to all the time. And also I have playlists from various parts of my life. And as soon as you say you're going on something like this, everyone in your life starts to chip in by saying, oh, well, you must include that, and I'll be really offended if you don't include that song that's really important to us. So in the end, I was very brutal and I whittled down a massive spreadsheet of probably 40 plus songs, and I decided to go for the ones that they might not be the songs that I necessarily listen to, but they're certainly the ones that are the most evocative and have that potential to, when I hear them unexpectedly, they take me back straight away to a particular moment in my life.
Your first track is on the Pirates of Penzance, and I believe your childhood was full of music too. Could you take me back to those days?
Oh, I had a really idyllic childhood, Toby. It was just the four of us. So my mum's from the States, she's American. My dad is very English, and we didn't have any extended family. So it was very much the woods against the world. And my dad introduced my mum to light opera in the British tradition, such as Gilbert and Sullivan. And also my mum brought musical influences from the States with her record collection of the Beach Boys and the kind of 60s and 70s sounds of the US. But I was trying to think of a song that really would transport a listener to what it was like to be a wood growing up. And we had a real identity as a family. And the thing that just kept coming to mind was none of us can sing apart from my dad. So my mum, my sister and I are completely tone deaf, despite all of us would love to be able to hold a note, hold a tune. My dad had this booming tenor that he just loved to sing. And so my childhood memories are full of my dad belting out whatever song or piece of music that was in his brain at that particular moment. And Gilbert and Sullivan was a perennial favourite with him. Once a year, when it was somebody's birthday, we'd go to the local theatre. I grew up in East Sussex, down on the South Coast, and the local amateur light opera society would put on one of Gilbert and Sullivan's shows. And so, yes, this song, I can just, even as I hear it, I can see my dad striding around and he would perform it. He was very performative. He was a larger-than-life character. And this was his party piece. He was very proud. I think he learned it in his days at Sandhurst, and he would bring it out at parties after probably a couple of glasses of wine had gone around the table. And he was very proud of himself for being able to, as people will hear, if you're not familiar with the song, it's a real tongue twister. So I just am impressed when anyone can sing this at any point.
I am the very model of a modern major general. Life, information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England and Dakota fights historical, from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I am very well acquainted too with matters mathematical. I understand equations both simple and quadratical. About polynomial theorem, I am teeming with a lot of news.
The Major General song from Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance, and fond childhood and teenage memories for you there, Joe. Joe, we now move to university time for you in Cambridge, reading history. And I think also you decided to get involved in rowing, as it seemed to be the done thing to do. Was it quite a big thing getting a place in Cambridge for you and your school at that time?
It really was. And I realised to people listening that I know how I sound when I speak. I have probably what some people think of as a very traditional English accent. And the funny thing about that is that comes more from the fact that my father was really paranoid that my sister and I would grow up with an American accent from my mother. And so he used to drill us in elocution at the dinner table, which is how I ended up speaking the way I speak, rather than coming from the background that I think people might assume goes with that. So although I sound like someone who you would expect to go to Cambridge, but I, as I say, grew up, you know, I was in this small town. I went to my local state sixth form college. I'd been to state school before that. And I hadn't really thought about applying to university. My parents very much encouraged us to explore all of our interests and to be really curious about the world. But their attitude was that if we wanted to be ambitious, then that was something we needed to self-motivate. They weren't driving us towards a particular outcome. As long as we were happy, they were happy, which I think is a really privileged way to grow up. And so I applied. No one was more surprised than me to get an interview. And no one was then even further surprised than me to get a place. And it was a really big deal. It was a really big deal for my school and my sixth form and my teachers. It felt like a real validation of them. It was such a big deal for my parents, who had really sought to, regardless of what our financial income was at any point in my childhood or teenage years, they'd always put everything they had into opportunities for my sister and I. So it felt like a real validation of the Wood method. Anyway, being Joe, and this is a very Joe thing to do, I was a very striving child. I always wanted to make the most of whatever it was I did, because often it would be the only time I do it. So, you know, I'd done all my research and I went up, and I wanted to make sure that after 3 years, I'd really had the Cambridge experience. And so the most Cambridge thing I could think of was rowing, because my dad and I had watched the boat race through my childhood and teen years. And so when I saw a poster for the college boat club, I was at Gonville and Caius College, and it said freshers rowing tryout. So I thought, oh, that would be fun. It was a taster session. Thought, you know, that way I can say that I've done rowing, tick that off the list and move on to the next Cambridge activity. And so I joined my college boat club, and then I moved up to the next one. And then when I was in rowing for our first boat, which is the kind of top team in a college, one of the more experienced rowers said, oh, you ought to try out for the university next year. And again, in the same spirit that I suppose got me to Cambridge accidentally in the first place, I thought, oh, well, you know, that sounds good. I'll give that a go. I mean, I won't get in, but it will be an experience. I feel like that ought to be written on my gravestone, Toby. It will be an experience. I'll give it a go. A really intense time. I spent an inordinate amount of time on rowing machines, which we call ergs, but, you know, the rowing machine that you'll find in the gym. And I can tell you there is nothing more boring. I challenge anyone to find anything more boring than having to sit on a rowing machine, just rowing at the same pace for hour after hour, sometimes, you know, between 2 and 3 hours on the particularly long sessions. And obviously such boring activities require excellent playlists. And so the playlist was always the choice of the crew, because we trained together as a crew. So you don't necessarily get your taste in music. I could have chosen any number of songs from the rowing days. And funny enough, if my crewmates were talking to you, they would choose something from Queen, and they probably choose either We Are the Champions or Don't Stop Me Now, because Don't Stop Me Now and We Are the Champions were the songs that celebrated our eventual victory. But the reason I've chosen this one, and the reason this one's a lot more evocative for me, is I had a slightly complicated relationship with the whole process, because unbeknownst at the time to most of my crewmates, my father, who'd actually been hospitalized on the morning of my Cambridge interview, so that was a couple of years before at this point, had remained very, very ill. He had a degenerative brain condition. And so rowing, the time that rowing took away from my family, it was a constant tension, because rowing, anyone who's rowed knows it's incredibly time consuming at the best of times. And so it had been a real trade-off between wanting to spend as much time at home with the family as possible, but also fulfill this thing that actually had come to represent for all of us in some pretty tough days, something, you know, a real beacon of hope, something really to get excited about and to cheer Team Wood on. So I stuck with it, but very sadly, a few days after I got found out that I'd made the Blue Boat, which is the top Cambridge boat, in the January of 2005, my dad very sadly died. And this was just 6 weeks before the boat race. And so when we did eventually win, which obviously I'm very proud of, and I was delighted because I knew that it, you know, it honored his memory, and it's what, you know, he and my mum and my sister absolutely wanted. It was, you know, it was a very mixed feeling. It wasn't the pure ecstasy of my teammates. It was very bittersweet. It was an element of quiet satisfaction rather than very excited joy. And out of all of the songs that we rode to and listened to, which usually had a very definite positive ending, this song remains ambiguous throughout. We don't know how the situation of the people it talks about ends. And it's just about being, even if you're not winning and even if things are going really badly wrong, it's about staying in the fight. And that's something that just powered me through that, you know, that really intense 18 months of rowing and the 18 months that followed, where, you know, I had 18 months left to finish my degree and to balance all of the emotions and responsibilities that were flying around after my dad died. So it's probably, that probably puts far too much pressure on what at the end of the day is just a great rock song, but it intersected with my life in a very personal way, and therefore whenever I hear it, it really, it's like I'm back there. And it was a song I hung on to, it was a message I hung on to, and even on the darkest day I could always manage a bit of a fight, if nothing else. And that's a way of approaching life that served me very well a few years later when the eyes started to go wrong.
Bon Jovi there and Living on a Prayer. For your next track, Joe, you have chosen one that takes you to an intensive work time for you in Brighton, and I think even an audition for Britain's Got Talent. What were you doing in Brighton at the time, and how did that BGT audition come about?
I moved to Brighton because I wanted to do a secondary degree. I wanted to do a master's in international relations, and then that job led me to take a, that degree then led me to take a job at Sussex University. And so I moved back to Brighton and set up life there. And it was a fantastic job. I was incredibly fortunate. I had amazing colleagues, and I'd been given basically carte blanche to set up a series of research centres and research programmes from scratch. So I was just in seventh heaven because I'm a complete geek. And probably the one thing that didn't get mentioned about Cambridge was the fact that actually, aside from rowing, which you could be forgiven for thinking was the only thing I did there, I did study history, and I loved history, and I'm a huge geek when it comes to anything academic. But it was a, you know, like in common with many startups or startup type jobs, it was very, very intense. It was a very big workload, which I love. I'm a work hard, play hard kind of person, but the play hard aspect is what keeps me working hard. And I've, going back to the childhood, one of the types of music that I really loved that I picked up from my parents was the swing music of the 20s, 30s and 40s from the States. That, you know, sometimes it was really jazzy and sometimes it was that real big band sound. And I loved that era and that music. And so I thought, I know what, I've always wanted to learn to dance, to properly dance, you know, kind of partner dancing that you could take onto the dance floor at a party. And so I took up two dance classes. I took up a tap class and I took up Lindy Hop dancing, which is the African-American style of dance that developed in response to jazz and swing music in the 20s to 40s. And it was this wonderful group of people. We had a mini group in it who we formed a really close friendship group, and we called ourselves jokingly the Hop Taps. And we would do a show each year as part of the dance studio teacher's local showcase. And one day he came to class and said, I've got this amazing, exciting news. And he said, one of my former pupils is a runner on Britain's Got Talent and she wants us to audition. And Toby, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I'm not a talent show sort of person, mainly because I have no discernible talent in order to go on a show. So I thought it'd be really fun. It was a day out with this great group of people. So our dance teacher choreographed a dance. It was to a song from the Andrews Sisters. This particular song, famously, they performed in a film in the 1940s, and they were dressed as belonging to the US Army, I believe. Someone's going to correct me on this, but I'm pretty sure it was Army. So anyway, we obviously needed costumes. So we decided to dress as the Andrews Sisters, all 30 of us. And we practiced and practiced and practiced, and we got a coach up to the XL in London. So we auditioned. We didn't get through. We had a great day. We didn't get through, mainly because nobody had thought about the fact that the sound system provided was you docked your iPhone or iPod into a dock, and then you heard the music through the speaker, which is fine if you're a soloist. But when you've got 30 adults tap dancing on a hard floor, funnily enough, you can't actually hear the fairly quiet music being generated through the speaker. So sadly, dancing without being able to hear the music, was not our best performance. So we didn't get through. And it's really, this song really represents what was a period of 3 years where I had this amazing life in Brighton. I had a job that I loved. I had great circles of friends. When I hear any swing music, but especially when I hear this song, it's not just a memory of the tap group and going up to the XL, but it's just a memory of nights spent dancing at swing dances, the people that I was spending time with. And that's why I will always love this song, aside from the fact that it's just very catchy. And I defy anybody to listen to this without tapping their feet under the table, or maybe getting up and doing a few spins to the rhythm.
Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy by the Andrews Sisters there. Joe, your next track is Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, which marks a time in your life when you went on a bit of a trip around the UK, but also a time when you started to lose your sight through a detached retina.
My life tends to work in a series of very unlikely coincidences of events happening. And what tends to happen is something really exciting will happen, and then very close on the heels of that, something fairly life-changing and not necessarily in a overtly positive way. So on my first day, I should have known this, on my first day of marathon training on the 6th of January in 2014, I went to the optician for a routine appointment and found that actually I had a giant retinal tear. And my optician was amazing. We went straight to the hospital, straight to A&E. And to cut a long story short, the next day I was in having emergency surgery for what had by that point become a retinal detachment in my left eye. And so this was a real shock. This just came bolt out of the blue. And it just stopped life. Life just screeched to a stop. It was my first day back at work after the holidays. And so this all turned into what started off as a bit of a freak occurrence that the surgeon thought was a freak occurrence, but the magnificent staff at Sussex Eye Hospital managed to repair, which is incredible in itself. I think people often focus on the fact that what happens next, but I think what's extraordinary is that against all the odds, they managed to fix both the tear and the detachment in a way that had saved the sight that first time in January. And that just, I still have so much admiration for the skill and the care that I received throughout both eyes, as it turns out. So I was in limbo. I couldn't travel abroad because A, I couldn't get travel insurance at this point, and B, I needed to be going to weekly and then monthly hospital appointments. So I'm not very good at sitting doing nothing. I wasn't going to spend a year just twiddling my thumbs waiting for things to happen. And so I decided that I've always wanted to do a big travel trip. And I thought, well, look, you can have the spirit of travel and do it in the UK. I needed to spend as little as possible. So I just decided, right, I contacted everybody I knew in the UK and said, could I come and stay with you just for a night or two? And so I arranged this logistical, I still think it's one of my proudest logistical moments, Toby. I basically arranged this couch surfing trip around the UK, staying with friends and then filling in gaps with hostels. So I put together a playlist for the very long coach journeys and walks and waiting at bus stops that was going to form a lot of this next year. And I chose the Bob Dylan song because it, out of all the songs, it really spoke to where I was at that point in life. If you listen to the lyrics when you play it in a few minutes, people will hear that so much of the story that it's telling. It's a fantastic song. It's got a real narrative to it. And alongside, of course, some of Dylan's slightly surreal phrasing where you're never quite sure what he's referring to. And this sense of being a down and out, of dropping through the net and dropping slightly out of normal society, of being on your uppers, having played your last card and it not worked out, all of that kind of feeling that the song captures was really where I was. And so it's not a negative song at all. It brings back so many fond memories of all of the adventures I had, of the vagabond existence that year represented.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
Bob Dylan and Like a Rolling Stone there. Joe, for your next track, it marks the start of another trip for you, this time to the USA, but I think only 2 weeks in, and you had another retina detachment, this time in your right eye, and you had to come back to the UK again.
So the backstory to this is you'd left me on my trip around the UK waiting to get cleared by my consultant in order to be able to travel. And so by the summer of 2015, he cleared me to travel, which meant I could get travel insurance. I'd always wanted to. I'd never taken a gap year, either before or after university. And I love traveling, and I'd wanted to do a big trip. And the trip I'd wanted to do for as long as I could remember was I wanted to take a cargo ship to the US. I then wanted to go coast to coast, and I wanted to do it not just from a budget point of view. I wanted to do it by working on farms in return for board and lodging. And it was also with a name. I'm very lucky because of my mum, I've got American citizenship. So this was also the start of me building my new life, that life that I'd said I was unknown, but I felt was out there. And so when I was designing this trip, I thought, actually, I just am not comfortable with jumping on a ship straight away that's going to take 7 days to get somewhere, because if anything happens to my eyes, I knew that I had to be in theatre for surgery within 24 hours, ideally within fewer than that, in order to have a chance at saving the site. And it just felt a real risk. So I thought, right, well, I looked at the map and I thought, right, if I travel overland by coach and ferry to the Canary Islands, I can have a bit of a sunshine break, you know, a bit of a kind of let go of the last year and have a bit of a holiday. And so it took 10 days to travel overland to the Canaries, and I got there and I was in the second week of enjoying my little holiday, and I got the symptoms in my right eye that I knew immediately meant that something had gone wrong with the retina. And so unsurprisingly, it was a series of tears. So I hopped on a flight and came straight back home, was in my consultant's office the next day, by which point it had developed into a giant tear. And so we were going to need to do the whole process again. And of course, we knew that last time doing the usual type of surgery had obviously resulted in complications, which led to me losing the left eye. And obviously myself and everybody was quite keen to save the right eye, because at that point, the idea of losing both, just that again seemed like something outside of my experience, because I still hadn't at this point encountered anything to do with visual impairment. That just wasn't a world or a knowledge base that I'd encountered or been told about. So I had my couple of operations at the end of 2015, and then had no sight in my right eye whilst we were waiting to see if things had worked. This was the pivotal moment, and it always sounds very strange to sighted people I talk to, which is that having no sight for that period of weeks was the best thing that could have happened to me, because first of all, it meant that whereas everybody up to this point had erred away from saying, oh, well, maybe you ought to explore support related to visual impairment, because no one really wanted to utter the word. Everyone wanted to be optimistic. When you've got no sight, that forces people to actually say, well, actually, at the moment, you're blind, so you're going to need to connect with X, Y, and Z. So it meant that we made our first contact with my local sight loss society, which is East Sussex Vision Support. And that was the moment where everything changed. So they were just incredible. From the first time my mum rang them, tentatively saying, my daughter can't see at the moment, but obviously we're not saying that she's blind. We're not trying to claim anything. We're not trying to be an imposter, but she is blind at the moment and we don't know what we're doing. We need to catch a train every week to go to the hospital. People don't believe she's blind. Have you got a white stick you could lend us, just because we don't know how to prove to people that she can't see? And from not only did they put one in the post that same day, and we got it the next, that was my first symbol cane, the first of many white canes to come. But we were in their system, and that meant that I got put through their support worker. And then once I was able to be up and about, through their rehab, really fantastic rehab support services. And I was, in the meantime, no one was happier than me when in the January, I started to realize that once the sight was coming back, I was going to retain sight. I was incredibly fortunate. I have retained a central portion of shape and color, blurred, but you know, good shape and color in the right eye, which compared to, I'd prepared myself for the worst case scenario that I wouldn't get any sight back. And I decided that actually that was doable, especially once I encountered East Sussex Vision Support. I knew that that was possible, that that wouldn't mean the end to life. And then from there, to get back a bit of sight, well, that was a bonus. But my world suddenly got very noisy. So I'd been somebody who in the past loved silence, and suddenly everything was talking to me. You know, if I wanted to do emails, they talked to me. I couldn't, if I wanted to read, my braille was nowhere close to being good enough. So I listened to an audiobook. I would just get to the point where I just couldn't take any more sound. I couldn't take audiobooks or narratives. I didn't particularly want to talk to people on the phone at the end of a long day. And even orchestral music or opera, I just found an assault on these really sore, burnt out ears. But there was one piece of music, which is the track I've chosen for number five, which no matter how burnt out or tired my ears were, I could always listen to. And it was also always my go-to piece of music before sight loss, but it was the only piece that I could guarantee that I would want to listen to on the hardest days of this, you know, 9-month period of recovery. And its simplicity and the clarity just somehow managed to cut through all of this noise that my world now contained.
Bach's Cello Suite number 1 there, and what a lovely piece of music too. Joe, we now come to a track that marks a time in your life, another changing point, I think, for you as well, when you were first introduced to theatre audio description, and you also say your VI life really started to kick off too.
I got registered as sight impaired in the summer of 2016. That meant that I suddenly had access to statutory support, which I hadn't had up to this point. That made a massive difference. It meant that I got the support I needed to start my job from Access to Work. And that is the period where I discovered that's the time period where I discovered audio description and theatre, thanks to my sister Mel, who, after a fairly disastrous family trip, ironically to Gilbert and Sullivan, at a local theatre that didn't have audio description, and that we didn't know, even if it had had, because we didn't know about audio description, it was a moot point. She was convinced that there must be a solution out there. She found the Globe. That spring trip to the Globe to see Othello, audio described, the whole experience where it's inclusive from beginning to end. You know, VI life for me went from being a very small goal of being able to get to and from work to cooking for myself, you know, to doing quite small basic things, those goals that I'd inherited for rehab. And suddenly that one audio described theatre performance, it was like this whole section of memory came back, where I remembered that actually my life used to consist of so much more than such small practical goals. And I love theatre and I love culture. And I'd forgotten how energized going to a really great cultural performance or exhibition makes you, how you walk away and you feel on top of the world, and suddenly you're thinking of all these things that you might aspire to do. So that was, you know, that encounter was just such a profound one. That was really life-changing, and it triggered a series of much more ambitious goals. I'd always wanted to go to something called Uphelia, which is a Viking fire festival in Shetland. I'd encountered it in history work when I was at Cambridge in my first term, and I'd always wanted to go. And so I just decided to book it. And I found myself on a ferry to Shetland with a group going up to see this fire festival, white cane and all. And it was indescribable. I still don't really have the vocabulary. It was everything that I had thought my life was going to be before sight loss. It was the adventure. It was going to somewhere a bit remote. It was doing something a bit quirky that not everyone does. And the quirkiness is probably best summarized, which is where the song I've chosen comes from, which is part of the festivities. If you look it up, is the Jarl squad, which is the Viking squad that year. They're male Shetlanders, adults. There are about 30 of them, fairly big guys, most of them. They dress as Vikings and they choreograph a dance to a pop song that they choose and change each year. The year that I went, 2018, that year's song was I Got a Feeling from the Black Eyed Peas. And I maintain to this day, Toby, that you have not lived until you've experienced 30 grown Shetlanders dressed as Vikings dancing to the Black Eyed Peas, because I just think that sums up the wonderful bizarreness of life.
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. A feeling.
I've Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas Fair, and a memorable Viking dance for you, Joe. Now, Joe, we come to your final track, the one that you would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
So the track is Taint What You Do, and it's this version is performed by Jimmy Lunsford. It's also famously performed by Ella Fitzgerald. But the reason I chose Jimmy's version is that in swing dancing, there's emerged a group dance called the Shim Sham, which is a choreographed dance that everyone does the same moves at the same time. And the piece of music they do it to is this track. And not only does it bring back all the wonderful memories of all the dances I've been to where everyone gets on the floor and does this at some point in the evening, but it also represents all of the important things in life. It's that sense of community, it's people, it's a combined effort, it's belonging at the same time as being independent, and just the fun that you have when a song comes on and everyone gets on the dance floor and everyone knows what they're doing.
Well, thank you, Joe Wood, for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks so much, Toby. And I think it's safe to say that I've definitely arrived in the visually impaired world now I've been on Tracks of My Life.